right, the Senate Committee on Human Services will come to order. It is Wednesday, February 22nd. Welcome. It's nice to have all of you joining us today. We are not going in order of what is on the agenda. So just for your planning, we're going to do Senate Bill 652 first in its entirety. Then we're going to go back to the work sessions, which won't take us very long. And then we will do the 262 and then 263. So, with that, I'm going to open up a public hearing on Senate Bill 652.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 652 establishes an automatic restraining order against a petitioner in the Family Abuse Prevention Act proceedings, and which restrains the petitioner from directly or indirectly causing the respondent to violate provisions of an order for relief. It permits the court to find a petitioner in contempt of a violation of a restraining order and provides respondent with an affirmative defense in a contempt proceeding. The measure permits the petitioner to apply for modification or revocation of the restraining order and establishes notice requirements. There also is a dash one amendment that was submitted, which clarifies the language as to what the automatic restraining order restricts, and also adds an emergency clause.
Thank you. You added an emergency clause?
Emergency clause?
So we know Senator Olson will have a question. We've got Senator Cruz and Matt Minahan, please. Welcome to Wednesday.
Thank you, Madam Chair, for rearranging your schedule. I also have to be at another committee to testify on the work product of the Attorney General's Public Records Task Force, which I was a member of.
You work too hard, Senator.
I'm Jeff Cruz, State Senator, Senate District 1. Very simply, number one, the bill isn't a finished product yet. We still need some more work and some more refining on it. Very simply, what we're attempting to do is avoid unintended consequences. Here is a prime example. Party one gets a restraining order against party two, justifiable reasons, and I'm not getting into that aspect of it. But currently, party one gets a restraining order against party two, preventing party two from contacting party one. However, if party one calls party two on the phone and party two responds, they have violated the restraining order, not through any direct action of theirs. And I would also point out that, for personal history, way back before the Stone Age, when I was married, when we were going through a divorce, my wife got a restraining order against me, which prohibited me at that point in time from attending school events that my kids were involved in because we'd be in the same room. And that's not direct contact, that's indirect contact, and that sort of thing should be allowed as long as I, you know, so I can watch what my kids are doing. So basically, we want this to be a direct contact issue, but if party one feels necessary to get a restraining order against party two, so party two does not contact them, party one should also not be contacting party two for basically the same reasons. And we have many, many cases where that has happened and party two is in violation of the restraining order and has legal action taken against them. And I, you know, it's quite simply, no contact is no contact. It should apply to both parties.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Chair Gelser, members of the committee, my name is Matt Minahan, and I represent Dad's America, and I'm here in support of Senate Bill 652-1. And before I get started, I want to point out I handed in some hard copy testimony from Mr. Gil Feibelman, who is out of town and away from his computer, and he'll be sending that in to OLIS later. I won't touch on it other than to say he urges support for Senate Bill 652 with the dash one amendment, and that Mr. Feibelman is the past chair of the family law section of the Oregon State Bar. I designed this bill and the Dash 1 amendment through Senator Cruz's office with help from Mr. Feivelman. And let me be clear that our intent was not to affect the proper use of a restraining orders. Restraining orders are necessary, important tools. I did meet with some of the opposition briefly, and a point was brought up that the petitioner of a restraining order may need to contact the respondent for a variety of issues, such as visitation or perhaps child support payments. I would point out that the respondent is legally barred from answering such communication and legally barred at request of the petitioner, I might add. Here's reality, and I see it all too often as I work with parents subject to restraining orders. I volunteer teach parenting classes and help both men and women guide through family law issues. When the respondent is not happy with parenting time awarded, the respondent and there is a restraining order in place, all that's needed for the respondent is to initiate contact or for the petitioner to initiate contact with the respondent and hope for a response. If the respondent simply picks up the phone and says hello, the respondent is subject to arrest. This arrest results in loss of parenting time and a possible criminal conviction. And many times after this, parenting coordinator must be involved and current child support schedule is disrupted. Another common situation I see is sometime after a restraining order is filed, the petitioner will invite the respondent back in the home as they attempt to perhaps reconcile their marriage or relationship. If new conflicts arise, the petitioner becomes unhappy or the petitioner just simply needs to call the police and highlight the order. As Mr. Feivelman points out in his written testimony, the responding officer has no discretion in these matters and must arrest the respondent. I would point out that if the petitioner feels they are in danger or threatened by the respondent, there is no need to make contact at all to the respondent. In true cases, one would think they would not want to make contact at all. If this is the case, Senate Bill 652-1 does not change the protection at all. It still exists. As written, Senate Bill 652-1 protects both parties, as a restraining order should be designed to do. Currently, they only provide protection for one party. As Mr. Feivelman also points out, we feel this will not re-victimize victims. It simply bars the petitioner from making contact. And let me highlight why we entered the Dash 1. The Dash 1 changes the original bill to be direct. The original bill said indirect contact, and we didn't want the courts flooded with cases where the petitioner is saying, I was indirectly indirectly contacted. So we were very specific in that the Dash 1, it has to be direct intentional contact. And then there's also an emergency clause in the Dash 1 as a request from one of the senators, and it also applies to current and past orders. I will finish by highlighting how I understand the state of California handles this issue. In the state of California, if the petitioner makes direct contact to the respondent, the current restraining order becomes null and void. We didn't really want to go that far here in Oregon, so we just, again, simply wanted to protect both parties from making contact. And I thank you for your time and take any questions that you have.
Thank you so much. Are there any questions for this panel?
Madam Chair.
Senator Olson, can I guess what your question is?
Yeah, go ahead.
Are you going to ask about the emergency clause?
No. I understand the necessity. And I look out at this very young crowd, so this is going to be a joke that's going to go right over your head. Senator Cruz, party one, party two, or do they call on a party line? They're all going, what in the world is a party line?
Fortunately, that's a complication we no longer have to deal with. So,
for your information, a party line is when two households used to have the same phone number.
Or more.
Or more. and they would be on the same line. It was called a party line, so you'd have 8 or 9 of your neighbors that could listen to your phone call. So
yeah,
this
yeah.
is an explanation.
Madam Chair, if I could, just one more thing. I said there will probably be more modifications. I know the defense bar is interested also in looking at this and maybe doing some additions to it. I also know, Madam Chair, that this bill has a subsequent referral to the Judiciary Committee, and it would be my request that it get sent there for the final work on it.
Of course. And why don't we go ahead and bring Gail Meyer up, because I think she belongs on this panel. I saw you a second ago.
Okay.
Gail?
Hello.
Magic.
Madam Chair, yes. She could take my place. I do have
You need to go. Okay, thank you very much.
Testify. Thank you very
Appreciate
much.
Appreciate it. How did you hear me out there?
I was at the TV.
Oh, okay. Great. Oh. Very handy.
Thank you, Chair Gail. Sir, members of the committee, Gail Meyer on behalf of the Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers Association. Thank you for the opportunity to weigh in support of Senate Bill 652. Firstly, I just want to say at the outset, I recognize this is a very emotionally impactful topic and bill. What I'd like to do is just pull up maybe 10,000 feet and just relate some basic facts of what it does look like when the petitioner of a restraining order does initiate contact with a respondent. It's true, the restraining order only restrains the respondent. It does not restrain the petitioner from reaching out. Oregon laws, do put a mandatory arrest obligation on law enforcement. So if law enforcement sees that there's been any reciprocal contact, so text messaging, hello, response, hi there, boom, that's contact, that results in arrest. So it is a mandatory arrest situation. The respondent will stay in custody until seen by a judge. Usually the judges keep them in custody at least for a while. They would have the right to have a hearing within 60 days, but usually the hearing occurs more frequently than that. But they are in custody. This is not technically a crime. It is contempt. So there's no jury trial, but there is a maximum exposure of six months in jail as a result of a conviction. You cannot get it expunged from your record, so it's not really a crime. It's a contempt charge, but it does stay on your record. So it's present on your record as a contempt. And so if anyone were to do a criminal background check, it would be on there. It does impact people's ability to get housing and perhaps also employment. So there are very serious consequences that attach to the respondent of a restraining order, regardless of who initiates the contact. I think that a lot of those mandatory provisions of mandatory arrest and detention do presuppose that there is threat to the petitioner as a result of the contact occurring. Criminal defense lawyers are often appointed to represent people, the respondents, when they're charged with violation of a restraining order. They do have the right to counsel. Some of our members actually have a contract, and so they see a lot of them. People have said a good half of their cases arise from contact first being initiated by the petitioner. This can look the full spectrum of human behavior, from, you know, gee, honey, I miss you, please come over, to I got to get the dog to the vet, but I've got the flu, can you get the dog to the vet, to texting at 11 at night, hey, how are you, fine, to the petitioner actually seeking the respondent out and actually intervening and interfering with them. We've seen it always. Any response from the respondent at all is a mandatory arrest situation. So if a law enforcement officer were to see a phone that says, hi, how are you? I'm fine. That is a mandatory arrest. What we feel strongly that would be really maximally beneficial here is the affirmative defense that's in subsection 4B. This would allow the petitioner, the respondent rather, once they're charged with violation of a restraining order, to have an affirmative defense. It should be more narrowly tailored, but simply to say that if the petitioner reaches out on their own initiative and the sole response from the respondent is, don't contact me, trying to terminate the contact, that there should be an affirmative defense to that so that they not get convicted, so to speak, of the contempt. The other thing that we would like to see is that the respondent have the ability to have a safe haven by reporting these contacts to law enforcement. Right now, quite frankly, lawyers are telling respondents, if you have any contact at all out there, the last thing you want to do is call the police. And that's, quite frankly, not the right thing. If the petitioner is making it difficult and is putting the respondent in jeopardy because they are initiating contact, we want to be able to see the respondent be able to go to law enforcement, record that, and make that at least establish a record of it so someone else, maybe the law enforcement or the judge, might be able to advise the petitioner they need to stop it. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Any questions for Gail? Thank you both very much. We appreciate you coming today.
Thank you.
Next up, we have Steve, is it Bermer? Berger? Marcy Nelson and Melanie Stewart, please. Welcome. Thank you for coming today. You can start in whatever order you like.
Good afternoon. Thank you, Chair Gessler and members of the Senate Committee on Human Services. My name is Steve Berger. I'm the Director of Community Corrections for Washington County, and I'm also here as President of the Oregon Association of the Community Corrections Directors Association. Thank you for the opportunity to present before you. Our association, in consultation with the Crime Victims Post-Conviction Advocacy Network, offers testimony in opposition to Senate Bill 652, which would automatically impose a protective order, commonly referred to as a restraining order, against a petitioner in a Family Abuse Prevention Act, FAPA, proceeding. Protective orders exist to provide legal protection to people who fear for their safety. A protective order can be a valuable part of a victim's safety plan and are effective tools when they prioritize child, victims, and community safety. However, Senate Bill 652 is not consistent with best practices in community supervision of family violence and targets those seeking protection. Specifically, we are opposed to this bill for the following reasons. It makes an automatic assumption that petitioners who obtain a restraining order are mutually engaged in abusive behavior and that all respondents need protection from the petitioner. Second, it fails to provide due process and judicial review, establishing the need for protection provided within the original protection order process. And lastly, it's redundant. Currently, the respondent has the right to get their own protective order against the petitioner if necessary. Additionally, when a respondent is served with a restraining order, they have the right to contest the restraining order. There's no need to penalize all petitioners by putting an automatic restraining order on them. Since a solution to the problem already exists, it appears Senate Bill 652 may only serve to discourage people from seeking help. The Oregon Association of Community Correction Directors respectfully recommends a no vote on Senate Bill 652.
Thank you very much.
Hi, thank you very much, Chair Gessler and the members of the committee. So I'm here on behalf of Washington County Community Corrections and the domestic violence victims served by our programs. And I would like to express my opposition to this bill. My department works with both offenders and victims on the domestic violence spectrum, and we're committed to doing all we can to restore the lives of victims and their families. As a therapist and a leader in community corrections, I know how important the FAPA orders are for survivors and child safety plan and their resources. There are many resources that a person can only get if they have a restraining order in place. So there's a lot riding on a FAPA order for many people. But I'm also aware firsthand of the ways that perpetrators of domestic violence use things like this against their victims. So the sponsors of the bill spoke to the idea of petitioner phoning the respondent and the respondent getting in trouble. But we need to be aware that the reverse will happen if this bill goes into effect. And we're dealing with people who are invested in power and control over their victims and families. If they know they can get their victim in trouble and control them that way, this is how domestic violence offenders behave. So in my mind, there's no protection for the petitioners in this at all. And the person who has the pattern of controlling and manipulating these situations is going to use this, you know, this system against their victim. So I have some really strong concerns about that protection. The other thing that it does, it would needlessly restrict the petitioner's freedoms. So if I'm the petitioner and I'm the victim and I live in a neighborhood that I know my offender lives in and I go to the Safeway, the current order means that that respondent has to stay away from me. But now I have to sort of tailor my life around where my offender might be at any given time. So the example earlier of going to a child's sporting event. Now I have to wonder, can I go to this event or not, or is my offender going to be there and call the police on me? So we're putting victims in a position where they have very little help when it comes to their own freedoms and their own protections. And I have some serious concerns about that. As Steve said, it's redundant. Currently, a victim of domestic violence has to go to a judge, kind of lay open the details that can often be embarrassing and scary to a court to even get the restraining order in the first place. And the respondent has a chance to contest that order. But in this case, we're asking the victim to basically automatically have a protective order put on themselves with no due process. And they have no chance to say to a judge, hey, this is how my offender might use this against me. It's just automatic. So I don't quite see how that's fair. It seems unjust to me. So for those reasons, I respectfully ask that you that there's a no vote on this bill. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Melanie.
Hello. My name is Melanie Stewart. I'm a Portland State Criminology and Criminal Justice graduate, a co-founder of SCARS, Survivor Collective Alliance Reaching Society, and a survivor of domestic violence and sexual assault. And thank you, Madam Chair and committee, for hearing us today. The last time my husband attacked me was after my children and I had left. We had moved out, and he flung me across the room, blocked the exits, chased me through the house, pinned me to the floor, tried to pry my phone out of my hands. He kept me there for over an hour until I convinced him that I wouldn't call the police on him. And the way that I convinced him it was actually true was that my children and I would lose our medical insurance if he was arrested. A few weeks later, he called police mediators that we had spoken to a year before when we had a conflict and told them he wanted help because I was starting fights in front of our child, which was not true. I told them about the ongoing abuse, and when they asked if I wanted to talk to an officer, I did at that time. I'm sharing this small part of my personal story of abuse to highlight a truth of DV that doesn't quite fit systems of justice, and that is that DV abusers will do whatever it takes for them to maintain control. And if that includes lying, manipulating systems, using whatever tools they have available to them, they will. To be respectful of the limited time, I'll kind of briefly touch on a couple of effects that this bill would have had on my life at the time that I needed a restraining order. It would have placed an additional burden on me, and already so much responsibility for leaving, for keeping my children safe, for filing the restraining order, for getting counseling for myself and my children, and more, so much more, was on me. All he had to do was defend himself and come up with whatever lies he could come up with, convenient lies. I would not be able to get a job in my field of criminal justice, because when they do background checks, if you have an RO, if you have ever had an RO against you, no matter how long ago it was, you can't get a job as a police officer. And not only would this affect me in Oregon, it would affect me in any other state, especially states that don't have an automatic restraining order against the petitioner, because they would not understand that at all. It would just show that I have an RO against me, or have had an RO against me. I could go on for on and on and on and on and on about the ways that this would just terribly impact victims of domestic violence. But I hope you see that punishing victims for taking steps to protect themselves is counterproductive to safety, and it's just cruel. It's really very cruel. With women and children being murdered by their abusers every day, I cannot imagine any justification for encouraging victim silence. And that's exactly what this bill would do, would encourage more victims to be silent. And I just want to kind of leave off with a question, and that is, what is the intent in applying this bill exclusively to DV victims? Because FAPA orders are family protection orders, and there is a requirement that it's someone who you have been in an intimate relationship with and has lived in your home. So that would make this bill specifically to DV victims. Why is it not being applied to all victims of all crimes who receive either an RO, a stalking order, or a bench-issued no-contact order? If it's to be fair, then it should be applied. It would be applied across the board, and that's not the case here. We're just penalizing DV victims.
Thank you very much. Are there any questions for this panel? Senator Olson.
I apologize, because I always ask questions, because it's an area that I'm not familiar with. And so the only way to get through my little head what happens is to ask questions of those people that it's happened to. And I'm sorry that it's happened to you. But I'm going to ask, and I like to ask questions from both sides of the perspective, and this side of the perspective is not the side you're going to want to hear. But what happens when you have, and I like the party one, party two, because I can understand that. When you talk to petitioner and respondent, it kind of confuses me. So if party one gets a restraining order because of some nefarious act that party two has committed, but party one basically wants to really get party two and makes those calls and, hi, how are you, and there's a response, and immediately party two is in trouble. How do you resolve that situation? And I understand what you're saying about if it puts a restraining order back on you, the difficulty that it causes you. So how would you resolve the situation where party one wants to cause trouble for party two, just doesn't want to leave it alone? I want you away, but I don't want to leave it alone. I really want to get you in trouble. How would you alter this bill to make it so that if that actually happened, without the restraining order on party one, that party two doesn't get in trouble?
Can I say something?
Yeah, sure.
Just wanted to say something.
Anybody,
really
please.
Quick about that. I would in no way adjust that bill. I would throw it out. I don't think it's adjustable. And I'd respond to that with a question. Are the respondents or party two so unable to control themselves that they have to answer that phone when you call, knowing that they have a restraining order against them and knowing that they will be arrested if they answer that phone? They're so unable to control themselves that they must answer it, because most of us have cell phones. I would venture to say probably everyone in this entire room has a cell phone, and it has automatic caller ID, and they would know who was calling them and to not answer that phone.
Follow up. Mm-hmm. That's wonderful if you have a cell phone, but I use the old landline too. And the phone rings, and I pick it up, and I go, hello? And suddenly I'm in trouble. So how do you, if you want to throw this bill out, fine. Mm-hmm. But if you were to write other legislation to protect that person from a scurrilous, maybe the party one, which would be the, what would it be, the petitioner. There we go. Maybe party one went out and bought a throwaway phone and just called to call, just to be ornery. How do you respond to that? What would you do to protect that other person? And I'm not saying they're, whoever it is, whether it be female or male, are whole upstanding citizens. I'm just saying, how would you protect their right not to get in trouble if someone intentionally wanted to get them in trouble?
So I'd like
what bill would you write?
I think it's a good question. In community corrections, many of our domestic violence offenders have no contact orders against them and or restraining orders against them. And so our probation officers are often counseling, and that would be my word for it. I think that the party two, if you will, needs to be counseled how to manage that restraining order so that they don't get in trouble or so they don't lose their freedom. So we have had situations where party one would contact party two, and the POs are saying to party two, document that, let me know that that occurred. And if they do get violated, they go in front of a judge. They have a chance to tell the judge what happened. And I didn't know. I had a landline. I answered the phone. I hung up right away. Here's my documentation of what occurred, and that was my victim. So, you know, here's what's going on. So I just think, Melanie used the word management earlier. I think if you have a protective order against you, then you need to just really manage your life in a way that you are staying completely away and you're protecting yourself. So use caller ID. Maybe don't answer the phone. Maybe wait for the voicemail and see who it is and call back. I mean, the idea is not to inconvenience the person who's been victimized, but to keep the person who's abusive away from the victim. The person who's been abusive, it's on them to then manage their lives in a way that they stay away from the person that they've been harmful to. And there are many ways to do that, and offenders in our programming manage this all the time, and they manage it very well when they choose to.
And
follow up?
And that's probably true in a majority of cases, but there are going to be party one, the petitioner, is going to be extremely aggressive and say, I'm going to do everything I can to get that guy put in jail or a woman put in jail, and go out of their way to cause a problem. So how do you protect? I'm not saying that the person that got the restraining order is above everything. I'm just saying that how do you protect them and protect their rights while you also protect the petitioner's rights?
I believe there's a remedy for that. I mean, this is a contempt charge, and so the person who's in that scenario, the person who is being picked on, let's say, by the party one, has the opportunity to get some legal help, to go before a judge, to make a case about this. There's also the possibility that they can get a restraining order against the victim, in quotes, right? So they have a chance to go through the same due process of petitioning the court and saying that this person's a threat to me, here's why, and get a restraining order. We actually call them dueling restraining orders is our little sort of saying
what
about it.
Pardon me, what'd you call it?
Dueling restraining orders when the victim
can
do that. So that's already available to people. There are some protections there. I think the problem is that's such a rare occurrence that now we're putting a restraining order against people who would never even think to behave this way. But now they're in a position now where their offender can follow them around, can call them on the phone, can try to get them in trouble, can you know, manipulate them and control them in a way that is scary, and they know that, and so many of them won't even get protective orders because they're thinking, my offender's going to use this against me. I know how they think. I know what they're already doing to me with family custody and things like that. If I get this thing, then he's just going to set me up, or she, you know, whoever, whatever gender. They're going to be afraid of getting these protective orders. And that's not what we want to have happen. And that, I would argue, that'll probably happen way more than this idea of this rogue victim trying to pick on their offender.
So maybe you can clarify for me a little bit the process. And in my experience, when I've talked to individuals that have sought a restraining order, it's often after a great deal of consideration. Frequently, when I've talked to individuals or talked to my local domestic violence organization, there is a fear of actually pursuing the restraining order because there is some sense that actually increases the risk. And then to go to the court and lay that out, how significant is the burden
on the victim to demonstrate the level of threat that her offender is, or his offender is presenting.
You can probably speak to that better than I can.
Yeah, there's a pretty significant burden on the victim to demonstrate that. Not only do they have to write it out, and then they go before a judge, and then the judge reviews it, and then they have to defend or justify everything that they wrote out. Then after that, the process is that it's served to the respondent, and the respondent has a chance to contest it. And a lot of times they will contest it. And then when they contest it, the victim usually has to get a lawyer and do other things. So much of the responsibility is placed on the victim to seek out safety, not only for themselves but for their children. And if they don't do those things, they can risk so much. They can risk losing their children. They can risk so many different things that it's to me, in my experience, it's almost ludicrous to say that someone would want to get a restraining order just for fun, just to do it, just to make that happen, or to be mean to someone, because it's a lot of work. It's a lot of emotional work, and especially if children are involved, it can get so complicated and so dangerous.
Sorry, I didn't get that.
And as I said, you have more to lose. You have more to lose than just your life. I mean, most domestic violence murders happen when they've gotten the restraining order. That's when it happens. So you could lose your life. In my case, I told you a little bit about my story. I would have lost my children and I. We lost our medical insurance. So we didn't have medical insurance because when I filed the restraining order, he lost his job. So we lost our medical insurance, lost any financial support that would have come from him, all of those things. So it's not just people are going and getting restraining orders just, you know, because they're mad at their ex-husband or their husband. That's just not the case. That's just not the reality. And as far as calling someone, I mean, I could probably count on my hand how many people have a landline phone and have abused a person for years who's going to call them and try and get them in trouble on purpose. I just can't imagine. I'm sure that happens. I'm not discounting that happens or could happen, but I think the numbers across the state would be so minimal.
And there are times when that one-way communication is helpful. So with offenders on community correction supervision, many times they will, this might surprise you, fail to pay child support, maybe withhold paying the mortgage, maybe be kind of inconsistent about when they go to see or pick up the kids. There are times when we in victim services have coached our victim clients, okay, he can't respond to you, but you can at least send an email saying, hey, the mortgage is due. I've gotten my second notice. Please pay it. So there's in writing the victim saying to that person, you need to live up to your responsibility. No response is required except to pay the mortgage. So there are times when that one-way communication is useful. Hey, the kids will be at your mom's house at X and X time. You know, that's a time when you can go visit them. So there's useful one-way communication that doesn't require the respondent to violate their own order.
Thank you very much. Any last questions for this panel? Thank you all very much. And next up, we have Sybil Hebb, Aaron Greenwald, and Gina Skinner. Welcome.
Thank you. Chair Gelser, members of the committee, Sybil Hebb with the Oregon Law Center here in opposition to Senate Bill 652, and I really appreciate your giving us the opportunity for this testimony, and just have a couple of points to make as follow-up and clarification. First of all, the Oregon Law Center, as you may know, as I think many of you know, is a civil legal services provider. We provide free legal assistance to low-income people, and domestic and sexual violence cases are of the highest priority for our firm. Our mission is to help people achieve access to justice and to escape the bounds of poverty and to try to move forward in their lives in a way that will provide safety and stability for themselves and for their children. Domestic and sexual violence is the number one threat to our clients in achieving that goal. And suffering domestic or sexual violence further traps our clients in a cycle of poverty or abuse. So we're very committed to working with our partners in community corrections, law enforcement, prosecution, as well as the domestic and sexual violence service providers, the network of whom are here today in this committee hearing, and I appreciate their support. We're here today in opposition of this bill for a number of different reasons. Primarily, a protection order is one of the most effective tools that a survivor can use in achieving a safety plan. That tool is something that's useful in cooperation with a number of other service providers, including those who are sitting here today, in finding a way to provide safety and support for survivors. From a principal perspective, I have both principal and practical concerns I wanted to raise. From a principal perspective, and I think this has been touched on before, if we set forth that there is an automatic sanction that could apply to any victim if she is or he is seeking protection from abuse, that's a deterrent to a survivor coming forward and taking a step that they need in order to achieve safety. So we're concerned about anything that is a deterrent like that, especially if it is an automatic deterrent that is not made based on individual substantive findings by a judge that a person is someone who deserves or needs such sanctions. And that is a principle that is codified in federal law in the Violence Against Women Act, which decades ago was passed to basically say, generally in the world, we have full faith and credit from one state to the other for a different state's orders. There is no full faith and credit under federal law for any order that is issued that has automatic terms of restraint that were not issued after a finding by a judge based on evidence and a petition that someone is entitled to that protection. So any order that was issued under this bill, if it were to pass, would not be enforceable by any other state in the nation because of those principles that are codified in federal law. I want to speak just briefly to the concept of the affirmative defense that I think was raised earlier. The purpose of a judge's sanction and a judge's order saying that one should not have any contact is to make sure that that is a finite rule and that it is observed and given credence. If we passed this proposal, it would essentially codify the theory that it's an excuse to violate a judge's order because someone else asked you to. And I think that's contrary to the protection that is at the basis of the orders that we are so important in Oregon statute. I guess the last final point I would make is that other aspects of the Violence Against Women Act provide that many of the financial grants that come to our states are conditioned upon a requirement that states adhere to certain principles and policies that are set out in federal law, and passage of this bill would put those grants and those dollars at risk. And those dollars go to our law enforcement agencies, to our prosecutors' offices, and to the network of nonprofit victim service providers across the state that are so important to the safety services to our victims and children. I'll leave the details of the prosecution and other aspects to the law enforcement and prosecutor attorneys next to me.
Thank you very much.
Good afternoon, Chair Gelser and members of the committee. My name is Gina Skinner, and I'm a deputy district attorney in Washington County. I'm representing the Oregon District Attorney Association. I've been a deputy district attorney for, this is my 20th year. We are testifying in opposition to Senate Bill 652 for all the reasons that you've heard already. I want to address some specific issues. There was some discussion, Chair Gelser, you asked, of our last panel regarding the onerous steps that are required to obtain a restraining order. As I was leaving today, I grabbed a copy of a restraining order petition. The petition itself is 6 pages in length, single-spaced, in excess of 22 questions in Washington County. It's a process that takes almost an entire day. So a victim has to either take a day off work, get child care, transportation, has to come to the courthouse, has to sit down, has to fill out this entire pamphlet, then has to wait in line, in order, for her case to get called in Washington County. That has to be turned in by 10:30 in the morning. She doesn't see a judge until 1 o'clock in the afternoon. And then a judge will hear her explain the reasons that she would otherwise be eligible for a restraining order. She would have to indicate under oath, under penalty of perjury, that within the last 180 days that the respondent in her case has either caused her bodily injury, attempted to cause her bodily injury, placed her in fear of imminent bodily injury, or caused her to engage in involuntary sexual relations by force or threat or force. Those are very serious allegations, and there are many restraining orders that are denied, that a judge hears that petition and does not find that testimony to be credible or the information in the petition to be credible, and the order is not issued. These are not automatic. Even once the petitioner does take the time and the effort to go down, put herself at risk, as indicated before, by putting those words on paper, the respondent will get served with a copy. So they are on notice as to the fact that the restraining order has been brought against them. They have 30 days to file in opposition to this and to object and to have a hearing in front of a judge. At that point, a judge can then dismiss the order if they find that those that based on the evidence that's provided, it is found to not be credible. Once the order is in place, yes, the law does require that a police officer, that it is mandatory arrest if it is violated. One of the things that has not been discussed, however, is that the case law requires that those violations be willful. A willful violation is not an accidental violation. So if someone calls you and you just pick up the phone, the fact that they're calling you is not a prosecutable violation of a restraining order. You would have to have a willful action of responding in some way. Ms. Meyer, examples she gave were accurate in the sense that they responded with a text, they responded with a conversation on the phone, responding with an email. That then would be a willful contact of the petitioner. But if the respondent answers the phone and then just hangs up, even if they don't have caller ID and they didn't know it was them, once they heard their voice and they hung up, that would not be a willful contact by the respondent. That would not be a prosecutable violation of the restraining order.
Since we're on this discussion, I hate to interrupt you, but if the phone rang and he said hello, is that a willful response?
That would not. Senator Olson, that would not be a willful response,
okay,
because that is until you know that whom the party is to which you are speaking, you would not be willfully violating a protection order.
Thank you very much.
Respondent, as indicated before, also is put on notice in a number of different ways and is an adult that is making active choices. And at that point, they are going to need to restrain themselves and make choices that would comport themselves to the restriction of the restraining order. There was also a question regarding what remedies are available if it appears that the petitioner is continuing to contact the respondent. And the remedies that would be available is that respondent can document those, contact the police. The police can then contact the petitioner and put them on notice saying they don't wish you to contact them anymore, whether it's by assuming that it's by phone, email, text, whatever the communication means is. And then if it continued, that could be a crime of telephonic harassment. The crime of telephonic harassment, the B misdemeanor, which is actually the more onerous penalty than a violation of a restraining order because it's a crime, is if you contact somebody by phone or by text when you have been instructed not to and you don't have the authority to contact that person. So if you have a police officer that's warned you that this person is now telling you stop contacting them and they did it again, they could be prosecuted. The petitioner could get prosecuted for that. So, I mean, there are remedies that are available. And if the person, perhaps the petitioner, was so far as they were coming to their house, they were coming to their business, the respondent would even potentially be able to get a stalking order against the petitioner. Again, these are very, very extreme examples, as previously mentioned. But I just wanted to point out that these, there are remedies that are available to that person. It's not that they're without remedies. Mandatory arrest statute exists so that when the respondent who has previously been engaging in violent power and control tactics does, in fact, violate that order, that the petitioner isn't in the position of having to affirmatively tell the police officer, perhaps in proximity of the respondent, or it to be documented in a police report, yes, I want this person to be held accountable for this, or yes, I want this person held, because they will be then perhaps, that will be used against them by the respondent in some future violent action. And so those are some concerns regarding the legal remedies that are available. Also, if the petitioner at some point, the parties decide that they wish to reconcile, there is an ability for the petitioner to go to court and have it either modified or dismissed. So if that's a mutual decision in the future, which does happen, that available it is available at any time. So just very briefly, I'll just summarize that some of the other major concerns that the District Attorney's Association has been mentioned is the deterrent, that there will be many less people getting restraining orders, which means there will be more violence that will be experienced by victims and more violence that will be children in those homes will be exposed to over time. If an order is brought against a petitioner, they may have the following things: losing their employment, losing their ability to obtain employment, which are both ways that petitioners can obtain independence, which is the number one way that they can get out of permanently a domestic violence situation and be able to take care of their children. They may lose a lease or not be able to obtain a lease for their own housing, which again is another way that victims can become independent of their abuser. One thing I haven't heard mentioned is that if a petitioner wanted to obtain a gun to protect themselves from a violent abuser, this would prevent them from being able to obtain a gun if that's something that they chose to do. They could be used against them in divorce custody proceedings, used against them when working with the representative from the Department of Human Services, and it could be used more difficult for them to obtain any kind of resources or specifically domestic violence grants that are given out by the Department of Human Services. They are going to be much more at risk of getting arrested themselves because if there was a situation where, again, the person that is adept at power and control has gotten the petitioner in a situation, and then the respondent uses that against her or the petitioner, then it is more likely than not that she will end up arrested, and that arrest record, as indicated before, is not expungible, and all the previous potential consequences
and
would
Gina,
apply.
I'm going to have to ask you to summarize because we're past our time for this bill.
And the final comment, pass it off to Ms. Greenwald, is a stigma attached to the idea of making a petitioner responsible for her abuser's actions against her is counterproductive.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
And I'm going to have to ask you to be pretty brief.
I will be very brief.
Thank you,
Chair Gelser, members of the committee. My name is Erin Greenwald. I'm representing the Department of Justice today in opposition of Bill 652. There are just three points that I want to make in addition to the testimony that's been provided today. First, and I've provided copies of two documents. One is the 2014 Battered Women's Justice Project National Center on Protection Orders and Full Faith and Credit Review of State Statutory Provisions Addressing Mutual Protection Orders, and the International Association of Chiefs of Police 2012 resolution in response to legislation that was defeated in Georgia regarding mutual protection orders. The first about the Battered Women's Justice Project, what I would say is in my brief review of their 2014 compendium of statutes, 85% to 90% of the states in the United States prohibit mutual protection orders from being granted without separate proceedings by both petitioners and the respondents. There's a handful of states like Oregon that remain silent on this issue, and there's only one in my review, Massachusetts, that might allow it. I wasn't able to look at the specific statute to verify that. As towards the International Association of Chiefs of Police, law enforcement through that organization has recognized that mutual restraining orders are a bad policy. The resolution says that policies that support the arrest and criminal consequences for victims for violence violations of their own protection orders are harmful and counterintuitive and should be avoided as they undermine the purpose of the system that was created to protect them and hold perpetrators of crime accountable. And finally, something that that Ms. Hebb brought up, and I think is really important here, is the fiscal impact. So there are many, many counties, five in fact, in Oregon, well over $1 million that is at stake through the Office of Violence Against Women, resources and services that are provided to victims and survivors of domestic violence, that if this bill were passed, those funds would be lost to those counties. Those vital services would be lost to victims because those grants through the Office of Violence Against Women would be prohibited if this state passed a bill that allowed for mutual protection orders. So for those reasons, I would urge you to vote no on this bill. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Are there any very brief questions for this panel? Seeing none, thank you all very much. And that is all that I have signed up for Senate Bill 652. Is there anybody else that intended to be heard today on Senate Bill 652? Seeing none, I am closing the public hearing on Senate Bill 652. And we're running a little behind. We're going to move back to the work sessions. So I'm going, do you have the scripts?
Script away.
Are they in my pile or his pile?
Both
piles.
Here we go.
All right. I'm going to open up a work session on Senate Bill 101, which is the child abuse investigations. This has a subsequent referral to judiciary. There's been a group that's working on it. Would the folks that are working on it come up just for the record to indicate that you're all okay?
I'll tell you about it.
For those of you that are in the room, which appears to just be you. Welcome back, Stacy.
Well, do you, for the record?
For the record,
Stacy Ayers. I manage the Child Protective Services Program for the Department of Human Services. I am just here simply if there are questions.
Great. And so the Dash 2 Amendment to 101, this was the investigations on school district property. And do you want to mention who was in your group that was working, that was not the names, but the okay. organizations?
Yes, we had the DA's Association. We had multiple law enforcement agencies and chiefs of police, sheriffs, and others. And I'm trying to think of whether there were others, and I think there are a couple, and I can't think of them right now. So, but it was a pretty collaborative approach, and I think it was everybody felt pretty comfortable with the language that was put forward.
Great. And I've gotten emails from all of those folks saying that they are comfortable, and it does have a subsequent to judiciary, so it will get one more look over before it's done. Senator Olson.
Chair Gilster, I move to adopt the Dash 2 amendments dated 2/21/17.
Vice Chair Olson moves to adopt the Dash 2 amendments dated 2/2/2017. Is there any discussion? Is there any?
Madam Chair, that was 2/21.
2/21.
Yes.
2/21/17.
You said 2/2.
Oh, sorry. 2/21/17. And besides that, is there any discussion on the Dash 2 amendments? Is there any objection? Seeing none, so ordered.
Chair Gilster, I move Senate Bill 101 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation and that the bill be referred to the Committee on Judiciary by prior reference.
Vice Chair also moves Senate Bill 101 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation and that it be referred to the Committee on Judiciary by prior reference. Is there any discussion? Is there any objection? Seeing none, so ordered. And we don't need a carrier because that is going to Ways and Means. And I will close the work session on Senate Bill 101. And yeah. Next we have got a, do you have the special script?
It should be in your stack.
In the stack.
You ready for that one?
Well, what's next in your stack? We'll do what's next in your stack first. Okay, I'm going to open a work session on Senate Bill 310. And this was the vertical housing development zones that we talked about last week.
Chair Gilster, I move Senate Bill 310 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Vice Chair Olson moves Senate Bill 310 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Is there any objection? Senator Olson, would you like to carry it?
Sure.
All right. The motion passes, and Senator Olson will be the carrier. Close the work session on Senate Bill 310. Open up a work session on Senate Bill 395. And this is just for the purpose of moving it because it landed in the wrong committee.
Oh, we're moving it to a different committee?
Yeah.
Chair Gelser, I move Senate Bill 395 without recommendation back to the Senate President for re-referral to another committee.
Vice Chair also moves Senate Bill 395 without recommendation back to the Senate President for re-referral to another committee. Is there any discussion? Is there any objection? Seeing none, so ordered. Closing the work session on Senate Bill 395. Opening work session on Senate Bill 396.
Chair Gelser, I move Senate Bill 396 without recommendation back to the Senate President for a re-referral to another committee.
Vice Chair Olson moves Senate Bill 396 without recommendation back to the Senate President for a re-referral to another committee. Is there any discussion? Is there any objection? Seeing none, so ordered. Now I am going to open up a work session on Senate Bill 434. This is the Wildfire Damage Financial Relief Task Force. It has the amendment that removes the emergency clause and adds the renter.
Chair Gelser, I move to adopt the Dash 1 amendment dated 2/21/17.
Senator Olson moves to adopt the Dash 1 amendments dated 2/21/17. Is there any discussion? Is there any objection? Seeing none, so ordered.
Chair Gelser, I move Senate Bill 434 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation and that the bill be referred to the Committee on General Government and Accountability and subsequently to the Joint Committee on Ways and Means by prior reference.
Well, that was a mouthful.
Yeah, it was. And you're going to say the same thing.
I'm going to use the script. Vice Chair Olson moves Senate Bill 434 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation and that it be referred to the Committee on General Government and Accountability and subsequently that it be referred to the Joint Committee on Ways and Means by prior reference. Did you get all that? Is there any discussion? Is there any objection? Seeing none, so ordered. Doesn't need a carrier. Closing the work session on Senate Bill 434. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. We did it.
Good.
Okay, we made it through the work sessions. I'm now.
Bye.
Pause. Please hold. We're going to open up a public hearing on Senate Bill 263. We're going to move to 263 first. So I'm opening up a public hearing on Senate Bill 263.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 263 establishes requirements for abbreviated school day programs. It limits the school district's ability to require student participation in an abbreviated school day program to safety or medical reasons only. It also defines terms.
Thank you very much. And I'd like to start with Bob Jundiff, Lana McMichael, and Hannah Pullen. Did I correctly guess that panel? Welcome.
Chair Gelser, members of the committee, thank you for allowing me to testify today on Senate Bill 263. My name is Bob Jundiff. I'm the director of Disability Rights Oregon. And Disability Rights Oregon is a nonprofit law office that provides legal assistance to people with disabilities across the state of Oregon. We've been in operation for 40 years, and one of the tasks that we've engaged in for all those 40 years is representing families and children in special education matters, enforcing their rights under federal and state law. when they're having difficulty obtaining the educational services that they need. In recent years, we've seen a steady increase in problems coming to us having to do with children being excluded from school because of their behaviors in school. And when a child's behaviors create difficulties in school or danger in school, it may be appropriate to remove them from school for a period of time in order to evaluate why those behaviors are happening and what can be done in order to address the behaviors so that the student can be returned safely to school. However, in recent years, we've seen more and more instances in which the student does not receive the needed services and assessments that they need in order to have an effective behavioral plan put in place so that they can work to returning to school in order to receive the education that they need in order to progress in life and to be successful. In our efforts to understand the problem, we have worked with the Department of Education here in Oregon, and we found that the department does not have data collected in order to understand how many children are out of school, and if if and whether their needs are being met. Pretty much the system is set up on a case-by-case basis so that if a parent does complain to the Department of Education, they can try to resolve that problem in that manner. However, we and our partners who work in this area have seen a continuing increase in situations in which children are excluded from school. And by excluded, what that means is that a child may be living at home, may receive an hour a day of tutoring at home, and this could go on for weeks, months, and even years. Senate Bill 263 would address this particular problem. It builds upon work, again, that we started with the Department of Education that resulted in the Department of Education issuing a policy directive explaining to schools their obligations under the federal and state special education laws to provide adequate assessments and services to their students. However, frankly, we just don't seem to be gaining traction. We continue to see more and more of these cases. Our sense is that there needs to be a clearer directive at the state level and so that schools understand what their obligations are when it comes to students who pose these challenges, particularly in the area of behaviors and in children who have medical needs that may be difficult to meet in the school setting. So Senate Bill 263 would apply to children 5 to 22 who are receiving special education services or may have medical conditions that have prevented them from attending full day school. And what the bill does is it requires school districts to take the types of steps that I've just outlined to you, which are to when a student is experiencing difficulties that might be dangerous in school or their health may be affecting their ability to attend school, that the school makes a timely assessment of the child's needs and puts in place a plan that is geared toward returning the child to school safely in a reasonable period of time, and that the parent is fully engaged in this process, and the parents receive adequate notifications so that they understand what's happening and can and participate in putting together a plan and then have a plan to return the child to school. The bill goes further in that it would require a data collecting process so that schools would collect information about how many children are being excluded from school due to these problems and to communicate that data to the State Department of Education. That is the bill in a nutshell. Today, we will have testimony from parents and others who've experienced the types of problems that come to us and come to our partner agencies so that you can see what the effect that this has upon both the individual student and their families.
Very much. Welcome. Sure. And you just need to start with introducing yourself for the record.
Okay. My name is Hannah Pullen, and I'm here to support 263. I am the mother of Logan Toma. He's a 10-year-old fifth grader, and he attends Washington Elementary in Pendleton. He is a child that has Asperger's and ADHD, but he's very high functioning. Logan has attended a full day of school from first grade until right before Christmas break of third grade. He switched schools in the district. He was transferred to an ILC class with a smaller setting where they shortened his day to 1:15.
Can you describe what an ILC class is?
It's intense learning. When they shortened his day, they promised that they would add more time in the future. With the shortening of his day, I didn't have very much time to figure out what I was going to do with him because I do work full time. I am a single mom. I have sole custody of him. I don't get any help from his dad. I had about a week's notice with the shortening of the day to figure out what I was going to do with the extra time. My parents live in Pendleton, so I was able to get help from them to help me watch him. Even with their help, things have still been difficult, wondering how I'm going to keep my job with the shortened day. I'm thankful that I have family support and a job that I've been at for a long time that gives me flexibility to attend different things. His shortened day continued up until the third grade, and all of fourth grade. No time was ever added to his schedule until fifth grade. I went to the state level because I wanted him to attend a full day of school. With complaining to the state, they were able to let him attend a full day of school. I did reach out to Disability Rights of Oregon at that time because I didn't know what I was able to do. In the third grade, when he was going full-time, they tested him, and he was at grade level and above in some areas. Since they have shortened his day, he is well below grade level, and some that he's barely at grade level in some subjects.
How short was his school day? Could you describe what that...
He went to school in the mornings. On Mondays, it's from 8:15 until 1:15. And then Tuesday through Friday, it's from 9:15 to 1:15. It's now shortened as of January 12th of this year. He only goes to school for 3 hours. He goes to school from noon until 3. As of February 14th, they added 15 minutes. And so he is now going to school from 11:45 to 3 o'clock.
And is there additional education that, is there tutoring or
he is completely excluded from other children. He does one-on-one tutoring. They're hoping that with that, that he might be back at grade level. In Pendleton School District, elementary ends at fifth grade. And so there's really no plan in place on where he's going to be at for middle school. I don't think he's ready. 3 hours and 15 minutes a day is not enough time for a child to learn. And Logan's very high functioning. He's taken piano lessons from first grade until now. He's in a bowling league. He's able to interact with other kids his age. At bowling, he can be there for up to 3 hours, and it's loud, there's lots of noise, and he does a good job. I just don't think with the shortening of the days that it's preparing him for life, because he's only been going to school full-time for first, second, and part of third. Other than that, everything's been part-time. And he is very self-conscious. He knows that he's not at grade level and he's not where the other kids are, and he really worries about that. At one point this year, he came home and he cried and told me that he wanted to kill himself and didn't want to live anymore, and I don't think a 10-year-old should have to feel that way. So I would like to see there be a change for kids like Logan. He doesn't fit in the perfect autistic box, and so a lot of people don't know what to do with him because he is high-functioning. So,
and one other question, is the shortened day, was that a decision that you participated in as an IEP member? Is it outlined on the IEP, or is this something that is outside of the IEP?
Well, we met with Disability Rights Oregon, and it wasn't a choice. I was told by the school's lawyer that this is what they're offering, and that was it. And so I was there, I was a part of it, but I didn't have a say in it. So I just... Yeah.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Good afternoon. My name is Lana McMichael.
Can you pull the microphone over towards you? Thank you.
My name is Lana McMichael. I am a single mother of a 9-year-old boy who is autistic. He is a sweet, loving, also high-functioning little boy. He's verbal and has been academically very advanced through his years. He started school at a public charter school, and at the beginning of first grade, his autism started to interfere with his functioning at school. It hadn't been diagnosed yet, so I began to seek help and request accommodations at school for him. Because they were a small charter school, they were unable to accommodate him there, so I was instructed to register him at his neighborhood school, which I did. He was started at Cherry Park Elementary School in a behavioral needs classroom, which is a small setting with a teacher and a couple aides. A few days of very difficult transition at the beginning happened, and then he was able to successfully attend school for a full day without any extra assistance. the beginning of second grade. However, he needed, it was identified by the whole team of folks that worked with us, the principal, special ed teacher, myself, his therapist, that he needed a one-on-one in order to transition into class successfully. The school refused to provide that accommodation, and so myself, his therapist, and some other folks that we had helped come with him to school and stayed with him for hours in order to help him transition into class. After a few weeks of doing that, he was able to go to school again for full days without any assistance. Later in the year, because of behavioral issues, the school chose to reduce him to an hour a day. He did that successfully with one-on-one assistance from myself and skills trainers, and then was worked up to a half a day of school and then back to full days. They did that a couple times throughout his second grade. Third grade, he started without one-on-one assistance. He did great full day of school. When they changed his classroom without notification, he started to have more behavioral issues in class. He was then cut back to 1 hour a day of school. And after one particular behavioral incident, they excluded him from school completely. They offered 1 hour a day of tutoring at home for his only option of education, which is not a sufficient free and appropriate public education. He was not learning anything at home. The tutor was not able to engage him. He had no peer interaction. He was not gaining any other skills.
And at this point, he's a third grader, you said?
He's now a fourth grader.
At that time, he was a third grader.
Mm-hmm. That was in November. They cut him back to 1 hour a day of school. In December, he stopped attending public school altogether and was getting 1 hour of tutoring a day at home. I'm a single mom. I work full-time on an ambulance in Clackamas County, and I had to take time off of work when the school would call or when they would send him home early or when he had his days cut back. I ended up, when he stopped going to school, I could not find care for him and had to take FMLA to be able to stay home with him. That meant I had absolutely no income. Because of this, after a couple of months, I was faced with a terrible option for my child and for myself. I could no longer afford to provide for him at home. And he had no placement in school, and I could not get care for him all day. My son is now 2 hours away from me in Creswell, Oregon, living in a developmental disabilities group home so that I could go back to work. I have no doubt in my mind that if he had been able to stay in school attending all day, that he would still be at home with me. My son has lost out on interactions with his friends. He has lost out on his education. He is just now starting to attend 1 hour a day of school in his new school district. He has not attended a full day of school since November of 2015.
He's
now a fourth grader. Mm-hmm. I have lost career opportunities, taken huge financial losses, but worst of all, I've lost my son being at home. He calls me crying and begging to come home to live with me again. He calls me crying that he has no friends. I'm here in support of this bill because I hope that no other family ever has to go through what I have gone through and what my son has gone through. So thank you for hearing my story.
Thank you very much. Are there questions for this panel?
I have a million, but I'm afraid to ask. Sir, can I, if I may?
Go ahead.
I believe you could probably be the best to answer this. And I don't know, do we have any school board here or anything?
Yes, we've got school folks here.
Never mind then, I won't ask the questions. I'll wait.
So a question for you. When all of these changes were being made, the change in the classroom down to an hour, up to a half a day, did you have a new IEP placement meeting every time?
We had monthly care coordination meetings at the school with everybody there. We only did the yearly IEP meeting that was required for the school district, but we had meetings every month.
But the IEP is the Individualized Education Plan.
That's what I was going to ask.
So under federal law, the Individuals with Disabilities Education Act, for a student that is in special education, the services are outlined on the IEP. The placement, which would talk about where a child attends, what types of supports are there, the one-on-one aid. Was that one-on-one aid written onto the IEP?
They told me that they would not be able to get funding for that, so there was no point in adding it to the IEP.
And was there, at your IEP meetings, were they attended by the legally required people? Was there a person from the district with the ability to commit resources?
When we had the yearly IEP meeting, yes. The monthly meetings was the principal, the special education teacher, the mental health care coordinator, myself, my son's therapist, and every once in a while his father or an aide.
But when you had the monthly meetings and the school hours started to change and the placement started to change, really a big placement change from a classroom at school all day to at home, that did you go through that placement meeting with the prior written notice that said, we are doing this, these are the other options, you can...
Their only offered option at the time was the hour a day at home tutoring.
So on the IEP form, it didn't show there's this option, these are the other options that are considered, and why and how that meets the students' needs.
They had no other option that they were offering us at the time. I then hired Joel Greenberg, an attorney through Disability Rights Oregon, to help me get a different placement for my son, as an hour a day of tutoring at home was not sufficient.
Okay.
So we went through the process with them of multiple meetings and advocated for a placement at a school specifically for autistic children. Which he got into for a short amount of time for the summer program.
And then in the fall, that just...
He wasn't able to attend there.
And what school district did this all happen in?
David Douglas School
David
District.
David Douglas School District. All right. Are there other questions for this panel?
Madam Chair, has a bill like this been before the legislature in previous sessions? Are you aware?
So, Senator Munson, just good question. We have been working on this for a couple of years, actually, and what's been difficult, and I know I've talked with some of the school folks here, is to be able to name the problem, because what's happening is the kids are falling through. So short answer, sort of, but not really. It's getting the words to describe it have been difficult, because there are federal protections that say a student with a disability is entitled to a full school day, is entitled to a free and appropriate public education. For exclusion or limitation from school, there's a process that you're supposed to go to. You can't be excluded from school based on a manifestation of your disability. There is the Department of Education recently has sent out a communication to districts saying, you can't do this. You can't do this unless there is a severe medical issue or a severe risk to safety, and you have to provide those other supports and services like the one-to-one aid or the specialized school or these other kinds of things. But we haven't been able to find the words to do it, because it doesn't really get reflected in the IEP, and that's one of the reasons why the data collection in here is really important, to be able to look at who are these kids, how often is it happening, and who is it happening to. And in the years of work with Disability Rights Oregon and Youth Rights and Justice, who also has some letters in here, it's not just kids that are on IEPs or 504 plans. We're seeing this happening with kids that have mental health needs that may not be identified. I know we had a student that was an elementary age student that was in foster care and was placed in Durfer in a foster home, and the foster mother went to enroll the student who was a student with a disability, and the school district said, we are not equipped to handle a student like that here. We'll offer you an hour a day, which wasn't appropriate, so the child had to move again out of that foster home to yet another foster home to a school district to access their free and appropriate public education.
One other question, Madam Chair. I'm surprised that we have it in the Human Services rather than the Education Committee. Do you know why it was sent here?
I do not. When we got the advisory notices for committee referrals, this and a couple of other bills, I spoke to the Senate President's office and said, you should talk to the education chair because they should probably go there, and they talk to the education chair and they're here. This one I actually do think fits here because this is disproportionately impacting kids coming in and out of foster care, as we've just heard, is significantly impacting kids with mental health issues and kind of hits a lot of the human services issues that we hit, but it was a decision that I did not request for the bill to come here. Just to be clear, I did not request this bill come here. I did not request Senate Bill 262. I did not request any of the bills that have my name on them that are related to special education come here, but here they are. Does that answer your question? And I'm not complaining to the bill referral gods. So, are there further questions for this panel? No, thank you so much for coming, and I'm sorry for what's happened to your kids and your families. They deserve better, and families should never be torn apart because a child isn't allowed to go to school.
Thank you.
Thank you. Next up, we have Caitlin Shockley and Ava Bartley. Welcome.
Thank you. Chair Gelser, members of the committee, my name is Ava Bartley, and I'm the Advocacy and Engagement Director for FACT Oregon. And with me today is my colleague, Caitlin Shockley, who's the Education and Community Director. FACT Oregon empowers, our mission is to empower Oregon families experiencing disability in pursuit of whole lives in their communities. And since 2012, FACT has been Oregon's statewide parent training and information center through a grant with the U.S. Department of Education's Office of Special Education Programs. Basically, part of the work that we do as Oregon's PTI is to man a statewide helpline where families, parents can email or phone in and receive help with special education and related matters. So we're here today to share a data report that we recently presented to the State Advisory Council for Special Education, or SACSE, that relates to the issue that Senate Bill 263 is addressing. The data speaks to requests for special education help that we've received via phone and email from families on this helpline. We submitted the data report with our written testimony, so you might have already seen it. And my colleague, Caitlin, will speak to the data because she compiled it. So I'll turn it over to Caitlin.
Thank you, Chair Gelser and members of the committee. As Bob shared in his testimony, the Department of Education does not collect data on how many students this shortened school day issue affects in Oregon. We do have a data set. We receive thousands of phone calls every school year. Since September 1st of this year until January 20th when I compiled this data for SACSE, we received requests from parents of students with disabilities, from 468 parents of students with disabilities. And of those interactions, 12.5% contacted us because their child was placed on a shortened school day due to behaviors related to their disability, and they were calling us for help and seeking support and trying to get their child back to a full day of school. That makes up over 30% of our individual contacts, because unlike other questions that we get over our helpline, this is one that's really complicated, and there's often a lot of other impacts that have happened to this family, other things affecting work, affecting their ability to pay their bills, their ability to access child care.
Push the microphone back a little bit. It's super sensitive.
Oh, thank you. Thank you. So it often requires 10, 20, 30, 40 phone calls and emails between staff and the parent in order to sort out all of the complications and try to get the child back in school and support the parent's advocacy. 27% of these families were representing students under 7 years old. So kindergartners, first graders, and second graders, and that seems to be usually boys, but very, very young kids, kids that cannot stay home alone. So when these kids are on a shortened school day and forced to stay home from school for the majority of the day, parents can't simply leave them unattended or enroll them in a traditional child care setting since they're so little and have those complicated behaviors. Our data just clearly indicates that shortened school days are a widespread problem in Oregon, despite the executive memorandum that was released in 2015. We don't know if the Oregon Department of Education has any other data sets. We don't think so, but our data clearly shows that it is a big issue. We often find that the families we're supporting over the phone, the students haven't undergone a functional behavior assessment. They don't have a behavior support plan. So the things that might help them stay successful in a full day of school haven't been tried. And they really just kind of, it seems to be a quick process from having a behavior, having a series of behaviors, and being placed on a shortened school day. Often this decision isn't reflected in a student's IEP, their individualized education program, and often notice is given to parents just with a phone call or a letter home and no really official notice at all. Families are struggling with how to navigate this issue and how to get their children back to school. We can only provide them with kind of some next steps, some information on the rules, and some tips for engaging with their IEP teams. But other than that, we're sort of at a loss. We just hope this information is helpful to you guys as you work out this complicated special education issue. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Questions for this panel? Oh, thank you very much.
Thank you.
And next we've got Morgan Allen and Richard Donovan.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Morgan Allen here on behalf of COSA. And I just wanted to offer a couple.
Since we're not the Education Committee, do you want to tell us what COSA is?
The Confederation of Oregon School Administrators. So we represent superintendents and principals and building administrators. And actually, you sort of stole the comments I was planning on making, which is that we are here today to listen to this issue. We've talked about this with you directly. We have several of our special education folks here in the room that are listening that we confer with to try to get a better understanding of what's happening and whether or not the things that are happening are legal and or appropriate. I think those are very good questions to ask. And so we've also reached out to Mr. Junedepth and offered to sit down with him and listen to the concerns that the folks they represent are bringing forward and see if there's some place to find some way to make some progress forward or find some consensus. We do have some concerns with the bill as drafted, but as you know, we are always willing to sit down and try to see if we can find something. And we've made good progress on suspensions and expulsions, for example, and worked through some of those issues. And as I said, we have several of our people. I'm not an expert on special education law, but we do have several people from school districts here that we rely on to help us navigate these issues. And so we're here to listen and get a better understanding of the scope of the issues being discussed.
Thanks, Morgan.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Richard Donovan on behalf of the Oregon School Boards Association. Very happy to be here.
It's so funny to sit in this arrangement with you
in
a different
funny,
committee
you know,
room.
In my past life, I used to sit on that side of the dais as a committee administrator, and you know, you're looking down at me, and I'm not accustomed to that. I feel like that's deliberate in the design of the room. But with that acknowledged, OSBA supports the goals of the measure, and certainly, I mean, such compelling testimony. This is an area where students aren't getting what they need that's literally tearing families apart. And we would support trying to remedy these sorts of things. I think, Senator Gelser, you expressed some of the questions that are ripe. Isn't this, does this interact with existing law? Is this an enforcement issue? When? How do we properly define the terms? So we do have some concerns. And as Morgan mentioned, we'd be really happy to work with the proponents to make sure that the measure targets the populations that need the help and doesn't have unintended consequences.
Thank you.
I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Questions for the panel?
I just want to make a comment. I had the opportunity of visiting fourth and fifth grade classrooms at East School in my school district, and there and we are every one of the children here should be provided an education through the public education system. But when I was in the classroom, there weren't enough aides, there were not enough teachers, to deal with the problems that were already, that were in the classroom. So, you know, I don't know how we're going to solve this issue, but it's a staffing issue, and how we can get more staff and aides and behavioral specialists and nursing and all of these issues that we need in our schools so that an adequate education can be provided to every student is, you know, a bigger question, a bigger issue. So thank you. I just need to comment on that.
Well, and I think some of these issues are going to come back, especially around behavior, and we're talking about this across systems. It's popping up in mental health. It's popping up, you know, every place. How do we do collaborative problem solving, looking at what is it that's driving the behavior? What is it that a child or a student or an adolescent is communicating with the behavior? I think OSEA is going to be bringing us a pretty neat bill. I'm really excited about the work OSEA is doing around safety and behavior in the classroom, but how that relates to the use of functional behavioral analysis. And I know that that Ava and Caitlin talked about looking at these kids. A lot of them have not had that. So a functional behavioral analysis, you go in, we call it an FBA in special ed, you go in and you look at how is the child behaving, what is it that triggers the behavior, what is it that supports the kid to make different choices so that they can be successful in the daytime. And when those are done well, kids who have really struggled can really succeed. So I think that's a place of interest that we can drill down into. But I hope that we've talked about this for a couple sessions in different ways, and I hope this is the session that we can find a way to make some progress forward or communicate it better, because the stories we heard just frankly aren't acceptable. I mean, it's not okay. It doesn't make sense to me that it is compliant in any way with the Individuals with Disabilities Education Act or the Americans with Disabilities Act or our mandatory school attendance law.
It's certainly at odds with education policy generally too. I mean, we've been moving away from suspension expulsion. I mean, out of classroom time is kind of less and less acceptable. And yes, so we'd certainly be willing to try and remedy an obvious issue.
Well, and I would say the other point is, you know, we hear that, you know, from the fact data that so many of these children are kindergartners and first graders, and this legislature is focused on the importance of a full day of kindergarten and a full school day and how important that is for all students. Certainly students who have special education needs don't need less education than everyone else, and certainly not an hour a day.
Thank you. There are very few issues that I've seen in this building that to me really are emergencies, and this issue is, because when we have kids who are separated from their families, to me that's an emergency, and it appears as though that some school districts are not dealing with the issue. You know, it feels like it's just getting passed down the road, and we can't do that. And so these kids deserve an education. We need to solve this session. We don't need to talk about it, you know, through this session and then the next session. We just need to prescribe what's going to happen. I trust that Mr. Donovan, if in fact that is your real name.
Thank you, Senator.
And Mr. Allen, if in fact that is your real name. If you guys will engage in this, I think we are likely to come to a resolution on it. But we do need to come to a resolution one way or the other this session and get those kids into the type of education that's going to be successful for them and their families.
And back to their families.
Absolutely.
Thank you. And Senator Mason.
Just one more comment, because, you know, I think every teacher really wants every child, I mean, that's why they teach, to be well educated. And I cite my daughter, who taught for 10 years and finally, because they lost the A, she taught kindergarten, first, second, third. It varied through those 10 years. It was very difficult. She finally quit because she said, my class sizes are
are too large. I can't give the attention to individual kids like they need. She used to have an educational aide, and then that was cut to half an hour a day, and then the final year when she resigned, she didn't have any. And so it is a big issue, a huge issue, but I think it comes down to schools getting adequate funding to be able to provide all of the services for every child.
All right, thank you all very much. And I know that both of you are just really great at problem solving, and in the past I have high hopes, so I'm grateful that both of you are here to work with us and help us.
Thanks,
Senator.
Answers.
All right, so this will be back. I'm going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 263. I don't think we have time to do Senate Bill 262. Danielle, will you be okay if I reschedule that at a later date? Are you okay? So I think what I'll do, my understanding is we'll have a few more bills that are coming in that are getting referred. I think if OSEA's bill comes in soon, if it lands here around the behavioral analysis, and that might fit well with just the topics and who needs to be in the room. So I might hold off on and reschedule that so that you're not all having to trump down to the Human Services Committee all the time. We'll try to make it Education Day on the same days. Yeah, I miss seeing you all. So with that, I miss chairing the Education Committee. It was fun. Yeah, for 6 years. For 6 years. That's what it is. It's just like,
well, no wonder I came to this committee. You know,
all right. With that, is there anything else for the good of the order? All right, we are adjourned. With that, is there anything else for the good of the order?